This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to MJ Rose about her latest novel, The Hypnotist. It's out in trade paper, and it is a pretty exciting book. Hi, MJ. How are you?
Hi, thank you.
There's a theme for a lot of your novels that's reincarnation, which is a key, I mean, it's absolutely at the core of this book. So I'm just curious about your interest in reincarnation and what caused, you know, what got you writing novels about reincarnation?
Well, one part of the answer is, I've always written novels. I really wanted to be a therapist, an artist and a therapist. So what I really was always fascinated with was how people's past influence their present, the way it is in therapy. And up until this series of books, there are three of them. The first one is The Reincarnationist, and the second one is The Memorist, and the third one is the one that we're talking about, The Hypnotist. Up until these books, I've always written psychological suspense that really, including some have therapists in them, that really are always about how on a deep level, I mean, what they're about, not the plot, but how people come to terms with who they are based on learning about who they were. And so it actually is not much of a progression or a difference for me to write these books, because reincarnation is who we were just a little bit further back. So it was actually the inspiration for I'd always been interested in reincarnation for a lot of different crazy reasons. But what really happened was my friend Douglas Clegg, who's a fabulous writer, was writing a novel about Mordred and King Arthur. And he was doing all this amazing research, and he would call me a couple of times a week and tell me about this research he was doing. And I was writing all this contemporary fiction, and I was getting so jealous about this wonderful research that he was doing. And it kind of just inspired me to think about, I wanted to do research too, and so I wanted to write a book that had something to do with ancient Rome. I'd been to Rome and been fascinated by how much of ancient Rome is still there when you walk down the street. And everything just kind of coalesced in realizing I could still write about what I really cared about, which is how who we were influences who we are. And something that I'd been interested in forever, which is reincarnation, it all kind of just came together.
Well, and in this book, the therapist is a key, the role of therapists is a key element in the book. You know, the novel is called The Hypnotist. One of the things that is related to that is hypnotherapy,
right?
Which is used to what you have are, I mean, I know we're not talking about literally the story, but what you have is characters, many of the characters whose past lives are influencing or upsetting their current lives. And so there is this theme of therapy being used to help the client, as it were, integrate their issues to understand them, I think. I hadn't really thought of that as being the core, but it is kind of the core of the book.
Yeah, that's the part of it that really fascinates me. I kind of have to write plots and action to diffuse the fact that what I really want to write about is people's psychological states. But nobody would read a novel if that's all it was about.
Right, because then it would just be static.
Right,
it would be...
so I have to pretend that there's a plot. No, I'm kidding. There really is a plot there. But what really fascinates me is getting inside of somebody's head and figuring out who they... watching them figure out who they are.
Well, and you have a couple of really... main character. I mean, the main character, the one around whom the action is spun, is Lucian Glass. But there are other characters who are pretty major and significant. All of them have, issues, and they're all real. I mean, of course, one of the things that is interesting about this is I thought it was fairly complex trying to figure out who is related to whom and how everybody works together. But there is. As the story unfolds, and I hope, I don't want to give away too much, but as the story unfolds, all of the people in the book are connected to one another, both in their current and in their past. It's almost like this idea, I think that's the Vonnegut idea of the karas, you know, that you travel through time with the same group of people trying to figure out your issues.
Right. Well,
And
that's actually like a major theory in reincarnation.
right.
If you study reincarnation a lot, and at this point, I think I've probably read 90 books on reincarnation and met with people who are reincarnationists and past life therapists and everything. But most people do believe that that's exactly right, that you come back in each life into the same soul circle. And I should say the books aren't very. They're not religious. They're not. I'm not preaching about reincarnation. I actually write the books for people who don't believe in it.
Right,
I'm
I
not
was going to
trying to.
say you don't have to have any.
No.
I would say, you know, I mean, I have some familiarity with reincarnation as a, you know, both in the Hindu and other religious forms, but also in the kind of theosophical and the, you know, kind of Western tradition of reincarnation, as well as I know about past life therapy. But I would say that any reader who doesn't even care about reincarnation ism would be able to read this book as a thriller, and then and reincarnation is just part of it's part of the story.
Yeah, exactly. The best review I think I ever got was for one of the books in this series, was Patrick Anderson in the Washington Post, who actually gave me a full-page review for The Memorist, and he said that he doesn't believe in reincarnation, but he believes in good storytelling,
Right.
and then went on to talk about what a good book it was. And that's really, I think that reincarnation is really a literary trope for me. It's a really fun way to explore the past, and there's also an odd thing that happened. When you just write contemporary fiction, the real world, the world we live in, the 21st century world, is so full of mechanics and devices that actually make a lot of what makes a novel fabulous difficult to pull off. Like, nobody can ever miss a train or lose a person unless their cell phone battery runs out. And that gets really boring. I mean, there's so many novels now where the only everything hinges on the fact the person's cell phone falls down a tunnel. And I really was getting very kind of tired of the dramatic inhibitions that I felt or limitations I felt by only writing about the current world. And so the thing that I one of the things I really love is the amount of drama and real emotional upheaval that I can deal with in the past because of things that happen to these people that are very dramatic, that would be very hard to pull off now.
No, that's an
And
interesting point, I think. And I think a lot of people also find that the present is not as rich and interesting as the past. So what you've done here, which is kind of interesting, you know, I mean, a lot of people, you know, that's why people read historical fiction. You know, they want to be able to inhabit the 17th century England or the 11th century Spain or whatever it is. But you know, in this book, you get to live in the present and in the past, and the richness of the past kind of inhabits the lives of the people who are living in the present.
thank you. That was nicely said.
But it also, I mean, it just strictly, as you were starting to say before, I think it's a pretty exciting thriller novel, regardless of one's interest in reincarnation or not. I mean, there's some, you know, a lot of really complicated characters whose motivations, you know, you don't kind of fall into the trap of making them kind of stick figures who are motivated by things that, you know, that happened in other lives, or so you don't, that's not obvious
No,
as
I
we're
mean,
reading the book.
what the book is about is the book is about a police a detective who is an art crime detective who is investigating an art crime that a painting has been destroyed and trying to figure out why it was destroyed, and a bunch of paintings are being held hostage, and somebody's threatening to destroy them unless the Metropolitan Museum turns over a piece of sculpture. that they claim doesn't belong to them. There's a lot going on in the art world for the last 10 years about who owns art that was taken illegally from countries in history. So this piece of sculpture, which is the Greek god Hypnos, which is in the Metropolitan Museum in my book, the Greek government thinks it belongs to them, and the Iranian government thinks it belongs to them.
Right, and it was because the Iranians, it was
found in Persia,
looted from Persia, in the 19th century, or early 20th century, and there's a very long, you know, you have a lot of, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with the Iranians, they're going to all ends essentially to try to get this piece because,
and that's all based on history, on what's going on now. Is that every major museum is involved in very serious battles about returning artwork to the countries of origin. I mean, the Greeks are trying to get back the Elgin marbles from England, and they've been trying to do that for the last 5 years, and there are groups of people. They have a Facebook page to try to force the British Museum to give back the Elgin marbles. The Metropolitan Museum of Art gave back a huge vase, a Greek vase, 2 years ago to Greece, because they tracked it back and found out that it had been looted when people started excavating in the 19th century, excavating in Rome and in Greece and in Egypt. The Howard Carters of the world, they just took stuff out.
Right, because they thought, well, because this goes
finders
back to...
keepers.
Right, and it also goes back to the attitude of Western... You know, certain Western civilizations feeling that they were the pinnacle of development at that point.
Right.
So anywhere they went, they, you know, they could say, "Well, we need to preserve this for history, and we'll study it and put it into a context of our belief system." Whereas the original context doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it was
exactly.
A really kind of Eurocentric view.
Totally.
That happened here in America too with Machu Picchu, which is another one that's going on right now. Where the Peruvian government has gotten back from Yale a large amount of material that was taken by Hiram Bingham, you know, to bring back to Yale to study for the, you know, the greater good of humanity, without regard to the, you know, the people who for whom this was history, living history.
So that's really what the book. I mean, that's really at the heart of the book. Is it's a thriller about this piece of sculpture that a lot of people want, and the FBI is trying to make sure stays in the country. There's actually paperwork that looks like, I mean, in the book, it looks like it's legal, that the piece of artwork is here. And so there's a legal battle going on, and who's going to win, and who's going to take the law into their own hands and try to get the sculpture back. So that's really what the book's about, and there's a love story in there.
And there's some murders.
And some murders, yeah. And a heist at the Metropolitan Museum of Art that some people have told me, like, actually could be done. So I hope nobody who wants to actually break into the museum reads the book.
Plus, you also have some really interesting red herring elements, you know, things that look like they're going to be the answer, but may not be.
Uh-huh.
There's, like, a lot of things going on. You have a lot of moving parts in this story.
Yeah, I like to entertain myself, so my books tend to be a little bit complicated. I actually have a strange way of... I wrote the book without knowing, actually, who the bad guy was. I actually didn't name the person, and I had it... It was somebody else who wasn't even in the book, and my agent read the book and said, no, there's one problem in this book, is, like, you can't have the bad guy... not be in the book at all until, you know, you can't have this reveal at the end. And I kind of looked at the book and I realized, but you know what? The person's in the book. I actually wrote the person into the book and he's in the book the whole time. And I had no idea it was him until my agent said that. And then I realized I kind of set it up for myself. It was very strange.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask you whether you had built the story structurally in advance so that you could keep track of everything, but it sounds like you didn't.
No, I knew a lot of things about the book. I actually wrote the book knowing the big scene in the Metropolitan at the end was actually the idea for the book. I just the first idea I had for the book was that somebody's going to steal something from the Metropolitan Museum of Art and actually pull it off. And then I kind of started going backwards. But there were always pieces of my books that I don't figure out until I finish the book and read it two or three times. And then I see that I did, but I didn't know it. John Gardner has this great book called The Art of Fiction. And I read it every other year. And one of the things that he says in the book is that when you finished writing your book, you have to read it, he says, 100 times. I've never done that. But I read it 4 or 5 times, and I look for the theme of the book. He says that you give yourself clues as you write your own book. And the only way to find them is to finish the book and go back and look for the clues. And I've been doing that since my very first novel, and he's absolutely right. There are so many themes and little pieces of the plot that I don't realize I've put into a book until the first draft is finished and I start rereading it. And then I have to, you know, read it and read it and read it, and then I have to rewrite it like at least twice more. That's a kind of a complicated way to write.
So do you actually, that's actually a good question to ask. When you are doing the rewrites, are you doing them on your own or with someone else who has read the book, like an editor or an agent, saying to you, I've read it, here's some things that I found that, you know, don't make sense
no,
to me
I,
here.
No, I do. When my agent read that and said the thing about the bad guy at the end, I'd already done the rewrites. I just hadn't noticed that. I didn't think it was a problem that there was this kind of new person at the end. I didn't think anybody would mind. So the answer is nobody reads the book until I've written it at least 3 times.
And so when you've done the, how do you know when you're done? I guess that's really an important, you know, because I mean, it's hard for writers to stop writing. And how do you know you're finished?
Well, lately, it's because I have a deadline and I kind of set things up so I have to turn in the book to my agent by a certain date. And so I kind of leave myself like 3 months before that date. Like I have to finish the first draft of the book 3 months before I have to give it to my agent. And then I'm allowed to kind of rewrite it as many times as I can in the 3 months.
Right.
But at the end of the 3 months, I turn it in. I'm pretty disciplined, so it's just kind of a sense that you get where, like, okay, I've done this enough. If I don't let somebody else see it now, I'm going to go out of my mind. I get to a place where I can't see it anymore.
Right.
I have no understanding of whether this is good or bad or interesting. The really awful thing is, to me, and I've talked to other writers about this, and it's a funny thing, one of my best friends says, I call her every time when I'm writing a book at a certain stage, and I go, God, this book is so boring. Nobody's going to like it. And she says that every time, she says to me, it's boring because you've read it so many times, you know what's going to happen next. And I go, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm at that point. So that's kind of the point where I turn it into somebody.
No, I think that's good. So the process then, once you turn it in, and do you get back, notes, do you get back, you know, suggestions for changes, or do you feel like, you know, for the most part, you can say this is really done?
It's different with every book. It's been different with every book. On The Hypnotist, my agent actually, I had just changed agents, and The Hypnotist was the first book of mine that he read, as my agent. And he gave me back, he's a tough editor. I mean, he was an editor, and he's a tough editor, and he's edited a lot of thriller writers. And the book that I gave him, he said, you know, you either need to cut out some of the thriller aspects of this book or you need to beef them up. But you're kind of like in the middle here. And that book was actually, I think I did more work on that book like after I thought it was finished than anything that I've written in a really long time.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you feel like you're going to keep on going with more books that utilize the theme of reincarnation, or is it a kind of a trilogy that you'll finish with the Hypnotist?
No, actually, there's a thing in the books. I've invented this, partly based on real stuff. So let me just do a minute on reincarnation. So the way that you access your past lives is through deep meditation. And throughout history, going all the way back to the Indus Valley 4,000, 5,000 years ago, there have been different ways to go into meditation and different reasons to meditate. And a lot of them are very spiritual and esoteric, and, you know, Tibetan monks do certain things and Buddhist monks do other things, and esoterics, you know, there are fascinating ways that people meditate. So my idea for the books when I first came up with the series was that every book would kind of be almost a standalone with, you know, new characters. But what would tie all the books together is that I invented 12 memory tools. And memory tools would be things that existed in history throughout time that helped people access their past life memories.
Right.
And each book would be about a different memory tool. And so there were 12 memory tools, there could be 12 books. And I just thought that if the books were successful and I wanted to keep going, there were as many as 12 of them. I mean, obviously, you could always come up with more, but in my head, they were 12, and that they kind of formed a circle, and that the last book would, like, relate back to the first book, and I had this kind of amorphic thing, theory about it. So, and since they're not, they haven't been continuing characters, I could also end it, stop whenever I wanted, because I wouldn't leave anybody hanging. So, so I have a list of 12 memory tools. So the next one after The Hypnotist, I came up with an idea for a book based on the fourth memory tool, and that book is called The Book of Lost Fragrances. And we sold that book and two more to Atria last summer, and so or last spring, and so there are three more that have been sold, and those actually are going to have a continuing character. A woman who's a mythologist who gets involved with all this. But the first one's going to be out in March of next year. And the memory tool is, guess what the memory tool is with the title of the book. But the memory tool is a fragrance.
Right. And in The Hypnotist, the memory tool is Hypnos, the sculpture that you create, you know, you've invented, because there isn't, as your note at the end says, there isn't really a Hypnos sculpture. But it's made out of this really interesting.
Well, that kind of sculpture is real, right? So this
particular one is. Chris, I mean, there is
right. This particular piece of sculpture does not exist.
Right, but the Chris Elephant
type of sculpture is right. was a very important kind of sculpture in ancient Greece. Nothing still exists that was made this way in full, because it was made of a lot of things that are very hard to sustain over time. But the memory tool actually in that book is lost, and only one person ever realizes, only one person ever finds it, it's never used, and that
right.
person doesn't even realize what it is. And so it's never really found in the book. It's not the sculpture. But hypnosis is certainly a memory tool, and so there's a kind of like double memory tool in this book. But the memory tool in that book is still lost.
Oh, I thought it was inside the hypnos. So sorry about that. Well, anyway.
It doesn't matter. That's not what the book's about.
Right.
But it is lost, and nobody ever does find it. There's a guy in all the books, a secondary character in all the books, who is my favorite character. His name is Dr. Malachi Samuels, and he runs an institute in New York called the Phoenix Foundation, which studies reincarnation and has since the mid-1800s. Obviously, he's not that old, but his ancestors started it. And Dr. Malachi Samuels' goal is to collect the memory tools. And he kind of shows up in every book to lesser or greater degrees on the heels of the discovery of the memory tools. It's all he wants in his whole life is to get these memory tools. So he's desperate in this book to find the memory tool, and, you know, very frustrated that nobody finds the memory tool.
Right. No, it is interesting. Yeah, I love the Phoenix Society. It takes you back to the 19th century and this whole, that whole period, even the Transcendentalists.
Yes,
you know,
right.
The whole period of kind of resurgence in thinking about history in the past in a new way, where they were learning about religions around the world that had ideas that were, I think, that captured their imagination. And then psychology was kind of growing. You know, this is pre-Freud, but it's
Right.
the psych, you know, the psychology of the late 19th century becoming a real discipline. It is a really interesting period, and it's, I think it's fun if the if this organization is in every book. I think that kind of, I think that's a nice touch.
Yeah, they're like, it's like the foundation of each book is that it's there. It's based on a real foundation. There's a doctor named Ian Stevenson who died the year actually the first book was published, so 2006. But he had studied reincarnation for over 30 years and done over 3,000 studies of or done studies of over 3,000 children who remembered their past lives all over the world. And his goal was to just to prove reincarnation from a scientific point of view. And he actually was, it was at the University of Virginia, his foundation. It was completely, he's very well respected by scientists all over and psychologists all over the world. And he was not considered some woo-woo crackpot. He wrote several books. And I had done a lot of research about him. And I based the Phoenix Foundation on his foundation because I really appreciated the kind of effort he went to make sure that his foundation was never considered wackadoodles,
Right.
but that he really had a methodology that no one ever could find anything about that wasn't on the level about the studies he did with these kids.
No, it isn't. I mean, it is an interesting issue in itself. The idea, I mean, so many people have memories of past lives, and yet, so, you know, obviously most people do not. And so I think the general, the sort of skepticism that you face when you talk about reincarnation is that it just, it peak, people tend to only believe things that they can see and touch for themselves.
Right.
And so.
It's mostly children that remember their past lives, and people who believe in reincarnation generally believe that you're not supposed to remember your past lives. You're supposed to you're supposed to do it all over again this time and do the right thing. But that it's you know the little space on your mouth above your lips before your nose, that little indentation. There's a wonderful thing in the Kabbalah that says that's where the angel of forgetfulness puts her finger before you're born. So you forget your past life. Because the burden of your past life would be so great if you remembered it, you wouldn't be able to function.
Right. It's only the truly enlightened who are, I mean, and that's, you know, for Buddhist and Hindu religions, I hope I'm not misstating this, but I think the idea is that you are only able to deal with it if you have reached a certain level of self-awareness and enlightenment through many, many years of meditation and practice. The average person, as you say, can't deal with it.
No. And in my books, most people are not remembering it because they're religious students, but because of accidents. What they say, I love, the collective they, but what they say in all this reading is that most people who do remember pieces of their past lives are remembering them because they were very violent lives and things went wrong in those lives that shouldn't have happened or there were mistakes made, and that people are remembering them kind of like as a gift to have enough memory to know that you have to deal with something and get past it. Now, there's a really fascinating therapist named Dr. Brian Weiss, who was a traditional Jungian therapist in Florida, I think, practicing for like 20 years, when knew nothing about reincarnation, but had a patient who couldn't cope with something in their present life. And he hypnotized her. I think, I'm not going to remember what it was, but let's say it was that she had a fear of suffocation. And nothing in the therapy ever led to any understanding of why this woman would have a fear of therapy. So he thought something had happened to her as a child. And so he hypnotized her to put her into a regressive state to remember what had happened to her as a child that might help her remember so that they could get rid of her fear of claustrophobia. So he hypnotized her, but she went back too far. He didn't take her back to a past life. He said something like, you know, go back to when you were a child, to the thing that would make you so scared about being in an enclosed space, much more elaborately and elegantly than the way I'm doing it. And she went back to the time, but it wasn't in the present life. It was in a past life, and described, you know, the event that had created this trauma that she had carried over into this life, and it shook this guy up like crazy. And he changed his whole life. He started studying reincarnation. He's become one of the major regression therapists in the world. He's written several books, and they're fascinating. And he was the biggest disbeliever of all and wasn't even looking for it. So it is that, and that's really, they say that a lot of reincarnation memories or a lot of present-day problems are reincarnation memories if we only knew that that's what they were.
Right. Right.
Like people who have terrible fears and phobias that make no sense.
Right. No, it's, I think the whole reincarnation thing is very interesting. And I'm really glad we talked about that, because I really wanted to not talk too much about the story of the book, because it's complicated and interesting, and I didn't want to give it away. So I'm glad we talked about all these other things. So thanks so much for talking to me today, MJ. This is Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk, your host. We've been talking to MJ Rose, the author of The Hypnotist, a wonderful, thrilling, exciting novel that I hope everyone who's listening will want to read. Thanks, MJ.
Thank you so much.